I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve of this podcast.
Welcome to the CES Podcast, where PhD Bible scholar Dr. Sheldon Greaves discusses this year's seminary and institute curriculum with Michael Barker, a man who has a 14-year-old daughter in seminary but has zero training in biblical scholarship and so has no business even discussing the Bible, but is going to give his opinions anyways regarding this year's curriculum, which covers the New Testament.
So we, because of the length, the amount of reading with this last seminary and institute reading, we decided to break up our recording into two episodes. So you just listened to episode 5. Episode 6 will take us starting in chapter 26 all the way to chapter 28, which is the death and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth and the Great Commission. So please enjoy.
So let's see. Can we... Should we move on to the crucifixion?
Yeah.
You know, because this is very interesting. Now,
let me stop you. When you say crucifixion, are we going to talk about Pilate at all?
Because I wanted to talk. Absolutely. Yeah, okay, we should totally talk about Pilate. Okay. Pilate was, he was a real bastard. He basically lost his position as prefect of Judea because he kept screwing things up, because he kept provoking the people so badly that he was making the place almost ungovernable. Oh. When he arrived, the other prefects prior to that, they had shown some respect for Jewish sensibilities, and when the Roman soldiers entered town, they didn't bring their standards with their images and stuff, attached to them, and didn't post them around where they would be, seen by the Jews. But Pilate, he had his men bring them in by night and then set them up during the day. And that very nearly started a rebellion right there. And in fact, a huge mob of Jews went to Caesarea, where Pilate had his palace, and they basically protested out in front of the palace for 3 or 4 days. Mm-hmm. And Pilate was about to unleash the Roman soldiers. He was threatening to just, I'm just going to kill you all if you don't, let me do this. And they were saying, fine, kill us. It means that much to us. And Pilate backed down. There was another time when Pilate raided the temple treasury in order to build an aqueduct. I think we mentioned that
before. Yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, that went over really well. And then, in the riots or in the protests that followed, Pilate secreted a bunch of his men dressed in ordinary clothing among the protesters. And then at a given signal, they all pulled out hidden daggers and just started stabbing people.
Almost like the zealots would do with the Romans.
Yeah, then. Exactly. Hmm. And, thousands of innocent Jews were killed as a result of that. But I think what finally did it for him anyway, for Pilate, was there was another pretender, some messianic pretender, who claimed that some artifact of Moses was buried on Mount Gerizim, which was the holy mountain of the Samaritans. And okay. So there was this big movement going on there about, that there would be some big religious manifestation going on there. And Pilate just couldn't resist the urge to send his soldiers out to massacre everybody. And that got the Syrian legate, I forget his name, I think it was Vitellus or something like that. He heard about it. He summoned Pilate to account for it, and Pilate eventually had to go back to Rome and answer for what, for the way he had handled himself, and he never returned to Palestine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Now, how does he come into power? Because he's not a Herod. You know, we have no. Herod the Great. We have Herod the Antipas in regards to John the Baptist. Mm-hmm. What exactly is a prefect, opposed to a I guess later there's a title called a procurator or something like that?
Yeah.
Procurator.
Yeah.
So how's this all come into play in relation to the Herods and that crap?
Well, Herod was a local ruler, and he was essentially a Roman puppet.
Okay.
But he was, you know, he was also smart enough and powerful enough that he had at least some latitude. But Herod and people like him basically operated at the pleasure of the Roman governance, and that would have been represented by Pilate.
Oh, so Pilate was above him then.
He was a Roman, and he was really pretty much the ultimate power. He was the ultimate expression of Roman power.
Okay.
In the region.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, yeah. that context is very helpful. Thanks.
Yeah, sure. Now what's interesting too about this is that they're unable to get him on blasphemy, really, or at least to the point where they can, you know, where they can stone him. But the Romans, they're able to execute him, but it's for sedition, which is not the same as blasphemy. Jesus was executed as an enemy of the state, and there were three punishments that were used to punish enemies of the state. One was burning them, another one was feeding them to wild animals in the Colosseum, and the third was crucifixion. And the one thing that these all had in common was that afterwards there was no burial.
Oh.
In the case of crucifixion, at least, the body was left on the cross, and it was just left there to decompose.
Well, that's nasty.
Yeah, it was a truly ugly way to do this. And in fact, there were thousands and thousands of people that were crucified in Palestine. We have the remains of exactly one crucifixion victim. And we know he was a crucifixion victim because there's an iron, 6-inch iron spike driven through his heel bone.
Yeah, I've heard about that, and it brings into question, you know, the depiction of Jesus hanging on the cross. It's the nails usually through his feet,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, from what I understand, the one that you're describing, it's like one heel is on top of the other, and it's being driven through, you know, the calcaneus or the heel bone or somewhere right around there.
Right, that's right. And, you know, it's kind of amazing that we even have that one, because somebody was pretty damn gutsy to go out and gather up what was left of their friend or relative or whatever and, you know, and bury him properly.
Yeah.
That wasn't supposed to happen. So this is why the story of Joseph of Arimathea is so important, because, you know, he says, well, you can use, you know, first of all, the fact that they're able to take Jesus down off the cross because of Passover. You know, you can't leave corpses lying around for Passover.
Okay.
Is very important, because if you don't have the story of his burial, you can't have the story of his resurrection.
True.
You know, so if someone familiar with the times would have been reading this, was, well, wait a minute, how did he get in the tomb in the first place? He never should have been there.
Yeah.
So that's that's an important point.
I've listened to some debates with Bart Ehrman before on this point, and he doesn't believe in the burial story, and he said one of the main reasons is that if you were a criminal and if they eventually did take you off the cross, they just kind of threw you into a big heap with everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would make sense. For something like that, there were other instances where they didn't do that. Like, for instance, after the Spartacus rebellion, they took the remaining, 4,000, 7,000 survivors, and they crucified all of them along the Via Appia, which was this important highway leading into Rome. So, you know, here you are on both sides of the road for miles, you know, surrounded on both sides by rotting corpses.
Yeah.
But that, in that case, they kind of wanted to make a point. which they did.
That's nasty, man.
Yeah. you didn't mess with the Romans. The other thing about those particular punishments, too, was that if you didn't get a proper burial, it was generally believed that your spirit could never make it to the underworld. And
okay.
would basically kind of float around helpless and in pain and wandering and suffering. So it was like the wrath of Rome could follow you even beyond the grave.
It's interesting. So you have a couple of things working against Jesus then. Mm-hmm. So you have one, he's crucified. So he's being hung by on a tree, which, mm-hmm. you know, in Deuteronomy doesn't make you a good person, right?
That's
it makes
right.
you mm-hmm. that. Then you have, if you don't get buried properly, your spirit's just kind of, floating around. It can't mm-hmm. quite go,
that's right.
go where it belongs. And then, you have to have a resurrection story.
That's
but you
right.
know a lot of people have talked about this before. You know, the earliest stories told about Jesus, you know, that scholars believe is the story of the Passion.
Yeah.
You know, that would have been the mm-hmm. first thing written down. And we see, you know, with Paul, when he's giving what's the technical word for it, where he's saying, you know, this and this happened to Jesus, we believe this and this. What's that?
Oh,
I can't remember.
Yeah, I'm not sure what word you're referring to.
I can't remember which. Yeah. I can't even remember which epistle it is in. Mm-hmm. But anyways, it's scholars believe his well, let's call it a confession of faith regarding Jesus mm-hmm. of Nazareth. They date that really, really early, mm-hmm. Because it sounds like something he was taught and something that he learned to say. And so, mm-hmm. You know, you have all these historical things working against the Passion narrative, but then we also have these other things that kind of point to it being something that, you know, happened in history.
Yeah.
So for me as a believing person, and for me, you know, where the resurrection, for me, it is actually his death and resurrection is actually a historical event. It allows me to have faith in that story, I guess. It cracks the door open for me.
Yeah, it it should. I mean, look, if you're a historian, if you're an honest historian, you have to really acknowledge that Jesus did exist as a person. And the one reason we know this is that the fact of his being executed by the Romans as an enemy of the state is about as well documented as you could ask for.
Yeah.
From a historian standpoint.
Yeah.
You know, that there's your crack in the door. You know, beyond
yeah.
that, the resurrection, you know, well, you gotta go on the Gospels and you gotta go on faith. But
on faith, yeah.
But as far as that goes, I mean, this is really where this is where it got real.
Yeah, and it's important to the Christian message. You know, one of the interesting thing, and this is kind of this complicates the Book of Mormon as well, mm-hmm. is that from my reading, there was very little in Jewish thought in the first century that the Messiah would be a suffering Messiah, and that he would die and resurrect.
Yeah,
and it seems from my reading that the early Christians are like, holy crap. This wasn't supposed to happen. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through the Hebrew Bible and proof text the Hebrew
yeah.
Bible to show that Jesus of Nazareth was in fact the Messiah based on, you know, scriptures that we get in Isaiah
yeah,
and things
right.
like that. And so for me, that kind of points to is evidence that the early Christians really believed that Jesus had died and resurrected, he had
yeah.
suffered and resurrected. Now, the reason that complicates things with the Book of Mormon is because the Book of Mormon is, it's Jesus crazy. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Jesus is everywhere in there.
Oh, yeah.
Everywhere. And the thing is that these pre-Christian Jews, you know, Nephi, Alma,
mm-hmm.
they're prophesying of Jesus as being a suffering Messiah. So it kind of contradicts kind of how history played out in Jerusalem. So the strength of the Book of Mormon is that it's so Jesus filled. But on the other hand, there's problems with how the prophets of the Book of Mormon prophesied about Jesus as being a suffering Messiah.
Yeah. I mean, there are just too many details that they seem to have that the old world, Jewish tradition didn't have.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if it had been so easy to recognize, you know, if they'd had that much detail and clear, absolute, yes, this is what the Messiah is going to look like, do you think there would have been nearly as many successful pretenders as there were?
Yeah.
You know, probably not. So, yeah, there's...
It complicates things.
It does complicate things.
Now, for me, that doesn't mean the Book of Mormon isn't scripture, because I mean, I'm a believing Mormon. I believe it's scripture, but it complicates things a little bit. And for me, it makes me kind of have to reinterpret what scripture actually means.
Well, that's right. And that is a discussion for another time, but it's a discussion that's worth having.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's, just with yourself or a dialogue with others over a period of time.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're right. There are some problems that come up, but they're not showstoppers. They're not fatal problems.
No, they aren't.
So
what do they call the thing? There's a technical name for the thing above Jesus's head that told him what to kill.
Yeah, and I'm blanking on what that is, but it's that. What was it? Yesu, Jesus Rex Judeorum or something like that.
Yeah, that's where you get that.
IJNI.
IJNI, yeah.
Yeah. There we go. Jesus Nazarenus Rex Judeorum, which literally means, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews.
Yeah.
Then it also, we don't, and it was also in Hebrew and Greek too, which I think is kind of interesting. We don't have those words. I guess the Latin was enough. But that's he was killed as a seditionist.
He was
killed as an enemy of the state.
Yeah, and from what I understand, those words were probably the first words written about Jesus.
Yeah.
Because they predate everything else,
Yeah, I suppose that's true. I guess the only exceptions I can think of might be some of the really old hymns like the Song of Mary or the Song of Martha, but that depends on whether or not those were written before or after he was killed.
True.
And okay. I don't know the answer to that. I don't think anybody does. But,
yeah.
Right. And then there's also you also had a question here about his cry from the cross. Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? The reason they switched to Aramaic in the English is because those first two phrases, Eli, Eli, my God, sounds an awful lot like Elia, which is the name for Elijah.
Oh.
Which is the Hebrew word for Elijah. So they're thinking, oh, he's calling for Elijah to help him.
Oh, so it connects it for an English reader then.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Well, it would have also been for a Greek reader.
Okay,
that's what you're saying. Because it would have been written this, the Greek maintains the Aramaic as well.
Yeah.
And that's why they kind of go, that's why they have to preserve it. Otherwise, it isn't clear why they think he's calling for Elijah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. No, that's good. Do we have time to talk about Mary Magdalene?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
She's a fascinating character.
Yeah. So, when I understand, most historians think Magdalene means from Magdala, which is an area up north. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's right. she is a really interesting person because she keeps popping up in all these stories about Christianity in its early days, some of the radical Gnostic texts imply that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married, or at least very close physically. And of course, you want to get into the whole conspiracy. Want to go all Dan Brown on everybody.
Yeah.
There have been stories forever about how there were children from Jesus and Mary. And, you know, I mean, that opens up a whole other, avenue of good, clean fun, but one that really doesn't tell us a whole lot.
Yeah. Sells books though, man.
Sells books. Oh yeah. Sells books, sells movies. Yeah. It's a winner. So she, you know, I guess, you know, what else do you want to say about her? She was the one that, and the other Mary, you know, were the ones who basically, you know, were the messengers.
Yeah.
You know, saying, hey, he's back. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they call her sometimes the apostle to the apostles, you know, the one that was sent out. You know, what kind of caught me when I was reading the Matthean account here is, you know, there's this earthquake, thing rolls over, the soldiers, whatever kind of soldiers they were, they kind of fall to the side, right? And then the angel's like, he's not here, go check it out. But we don't have – the story doesn't say they actually went in there. They're like, holy crap, and they take off. They take off, right? It doesn't sound like they take off. And then Jesus appears, and he's like, hey, you know, here I am. And so it's – what stood out to me was up until then, there was the messianic secret, right? Jesus usually was like, don't tell anyone. Now he's like, go freaking tell everybody.
Yeah.
Go tell the guys.
You know, all nations, peoples, you know, that's what you're going to do until you die. Yeah. Basically, what he's saying. And, you know, the messianic secret is really a lot more pronounced in Mark than it is in Matthew, but you still kind of have him being a little careful. Well, I mean, let's face it, being pegged as a Messiah back in those days wasn't good for your longevity.
It doesn't sound like
it wasn't something you did if you wanted to be around for more than a week. But, you know, I'm glad you mentioned the earthquake too, because there was a belief in Judaism that the death of an innocent person, or I should say the murder of an innocent person, had the ability to create, you know, natural disasters, including earthquakes, and that an earthquake was a sign of, you know, the wrath of God.
Yeah.
And if you've ever been in an earthquake, you know, that's greater than, say, you know, 6.0 on the Richter, you know exactly.
Yep.
That makes perfect sense. You know, we lived in the Bay Area for a number of years, and I experienced, you know, the Loma Prieta earthquake, and oh my gosh, that's 30 seconds you do not want to relive.
Yeah, shake up. I grew up in California, so yeah, I can remember waking up and thinking my brother was shaking the bunk bed for some reason, and we're like, oh no, it's an earthquake in the middle of the night. Go back to sleep.
Yeah. So,
What was the Jewish view of resurrection? I've read some scholars say that most. Now, there were exceptions, like the Sadducees don't believe in the resurrection at all.
Yeah.
But most Jews, from my reading, believe the resurrection came at the end of time.
That's right. That's right.
That it wasn't something that happens and then things carry on for a little bit longer.
Which is why this business in Matthew about all the tombs being opened up and these dead saints, you know, get up and walk around and are showing themselves to people, that's a little weird. You know, because it is true that most Jews, not all, but most of them did believe in a resurrection, but there was the general sense that it would happen, you know, at the end of time or the end of days or something like that. So, you know, it makes me wonder whether the person who wrote Matthew thought that they were in some kind of an in-between spot.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Right about, okay, we had this, there was that, maybe it's going to take a few years for everything to kind of come together.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, I admit I'm speculating on that point, but it is interesting that that's even in there.
Yeah. It makes the story more complicated. So if no one believes a resurrection is going to come, you know, until the end, but it happens now.
Yeah.
Right. It's not what, once again, it's no one was expecting. Most people weren't expecting it, right?
Yeah.
Just like most people weren't expecting a suffering Messiah. Mm-hmm. Most people weren't expecting the Messiah to die, right? So you have all these things that were not expected that happen with the story of Jesus of Nazareth.
Mm-hmm.
So it may, but if you were like, we were expecting all this, then the story of Jesus's death and resurrection is less radical.
That's right. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a very good point. You know, I mean, this was a time when all sorts of crazy things were happening. So why not? You know, and you know, it's funny too. I'm trying to remember, but it seems to me that this mass resurrection of dead Jewish righteous people or whatever mm-hmm. happens. Does it happen before Jesus' resurrection, or does
happens both? Like,
yeah,
it's
right
almost like it
the
happens, and then all of a sudden it almost seems like it happens. Jesus shows up, and then the next verse, it's almost like the author of Matthew wants to correct it. No, Jesus has to resurrect first. Mm-hmm. It reads really weird.
yeah, it's very strange. That's the sort of thing that a scholar might look at it and think that somebody added something without really any real regard for the continuity of the story.
Yeah.
Which is possible. I mean, there's a belief, you know, there's a belief in Mormonism that a lot of stuff got taken out of the scriptures.
Yeah.
But in practice, the problem is more that stuff gets added in.
Gets shoved in there, yeah.
Yeah, it gets crammed in, and you don't know what's original and what's late, and that's you know, that's where Bible scholars like to go in and try to tease out the one from the other.
True.
But let's see, do we have let's see, is there anything else you want to talk about? I mean, we've talked about his commission to the 11 disciples, you know, to make disciples of all nations and baptize them, and I am with you always to the end of the age, and some manuscripts add amen after that.
Okay.
But
yeah, it's the Great Commission of all Christians, right?
This
radical story of Jesus of Nazareth, the Son of God, the Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
He dies, he resurrection, and somehow through that salvation comes.
Yeah.
It's a pretty incredible message. Pretty
radical.
It's still radical today, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, what's the mission of the Christian religion? Save the world.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no pressure, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, really, that's the way, you know, that's what it's about. And in the medieval church, there was a recognition that that didn't just include, you know, spiritual salvation. The church actually invented the word secular, which today means, you know, it's come to mean something that's non-religious or a-religious or even anti-religious. But what it referred to in the past was there was the sacred, which was the responsibility of the priests, the mm-hmm. sacraments, the, you know, the church buildings, that sort of thing. And there was the profane, which was everything that was arrayed against the church and everything that they did. But there was this big area of activity in between all of those that had a bearing on human dignity and health and well-being, medicine, art, literature, law, science, architecture, and that was what they called the secular.
Oh, really?
And the church.
It was like a bridge between the two.
Yeah, it was. And it was, and the secular was explicitly the realm of the laity, you know, the lay members of the church. As a member of the church, as a member of Christianity, your duty as a Christian was to go out and to engage in the secular world in those things that you know, are important for human, you know, for human development and so forth, and to basically make the world better.
Yeah.
You know, which is kind of ironic given what secular is now taken to mean, but, you know, that's history for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Words change.
Yeah, well, they do. Good. They have their own histories.
Well, this has been a super good discussion.
Yeah. I this is, well, there's good stuff here.
There's a ton of it.
Yeah, and we could go on for so much longer, but we won't because we don't have time. And
yeah, all right.
We don't want to burden your listeners too much.
So, as always, remember that history is not the point, but history is used to make a point. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I hope you guys enjoy this. I did.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you for having me, Mike. It was a pleasure as always.
This podcast is way better than freaking Hamilton.